be. But during the daytime in the week, I would be up in the Royal Courts of Justice hearing business and property cases as a judge there. I did about 20 odd years at the bar as an advocate, latterly in Silk as a QC, and then a couple of years ago I began sitting full time as a judge. And one thing we always say at the start of a case is, please turn off your mobile phone.
Excellent. And where is your lovely accent from?
Cornwall. I've failed ever since to get back there. And now, having accepted an appointment to sit in London, I think I shall continue to fail in that and not get back there.
So, just as we start this topic, I'm assuming you haven't always believed that the Bible is true. Can you tell me, what did you think about the Bible before you became a Christian?
Yeah, well, as a young adult, so in the sixth form, I had some good friends who were Christian believers and who tried to help me to believe. And I'm ashamed to say now that I rather scoffed at them. It seemed to me a lot of nonsense. And my view was certainly not the product of having read the Bible recently. I think it was more a result of being a 16-year-old boy. Like most of them, I knew everything. There's a very good, a lovely Mark Twain quote that rather captures how I was at that age. He wrote, "When I was a boy of 14, my father was so ignorant, I could hardly stand to have the old man around. But when I got to be 21, I was astonished at how much the old man had learned in 7 years." the truth is, my view of the Bible was stuck back in Sunday school days. I thought of it as a collection of stories.
So it didn't have any real relevance at all?
No, not at that time.
Listen to it. So what did you think then of people who did trust the Bible, who were Christians?
Nice but naive, I think. I mean, they were unmistakably lovely people, not least in their kind perseverance with me, despite my mocking of them. But it seemed to me their outlook was, you know, really wishful thinking. Certainly, I didn't regard it as based on any fact. And, I mean, it seemed to me a hugely improbable starting point that anyone was the son of God. You know, when such people have made claims other than Jesus, you know, we've either derided them or perhaps being more charitable, pitied them. You know, I think of David Icke, for example, in the 1990s. So it seemed to be a hugely improbable starting point.
So I suppose as a teenager, you didn't think Jesus was important at all.
No.
How then did your view of the Bible change?
Well, it came a bit later than 21, but I did come to believe that the Bible was true, and in particular about one central fact, which for me everything rested on, and that was the resurrection of Jesus from the dead. So if that happened, then what better proof could there be than Jesus was who he said he was? If it didn't happen, well, it seemed to me we could all carry on about our business. One old legal academic, Sir Norman Anderson, he said, it's either the supreme fact of history or a gigantic hoax. So that is the central fact I came to believe in.
So that's a massive change to see that the resurrection is true and come to believe it. How did that happen?
Well, the short answer is I read the Bible rather than talking about it without having read it. A slightly longer answer is that at that time, so I'd started at the bar, probably a couple of years in to that work, and I had a flat at the top of Brick Lane in London, which meant I ate a lot of curry. And the location was probably not very good, therefore, for my physical health. but turned out to be good for my spiritual health because I got taken along to the local church, St. Helens Bishopsgate. And a visit there certainly didn't convince me that the Christian claims were true, but it did make me want to look into it properly. I mean, firstly, I think it showed me that it was important to look into it, so that, I mean, if Jesus really was who he said he was, then what he said was true, and it would be, you know, silly to go on pretending otherwise. And also, I don't know quite what I was expecting, but the people there, they all seemed to look fairly ordinary and sane. I mean, I was probably expecting a sort of collection of characters from the Mos Eisley bar in Star Wars, you know, sort of a couple of heads and green skin and what have you. But the fact that they looked sane and ordinary and believed it, as I say, didn't convince me it was true, but it did seem to me to mean that perhaps there was something here that needed to be looked into. And yeah, that's what I did. So I read the gospel accounts in the Bible, read books about the gospel accounts, and as I did that, I became convinced that Jesus was who he said he was, however improbable that seemed to me to begin with. I mean, at least for me, when I really started engaging with the evidence, I was driven to the conclusion that Jesus was who he said he was.
So, given the fact that people who trust the Bible aren't Star Wars weird alien people, and the Bible can be trusted, just thinking of your profession, how is it in such a kind of career that requires evidence and kind of careful argument that you can trust the Bible? How does that fit in with your work?
I think actually it fits in rather well, because I say it's, to me, it rested on this central fact. And, you know, life in court is about examining whether something is true by reference to the evidence. And so far as the Bible is concerned, you get over pretty quickly, I think, the reliability of the documents, so that there are so many copies of the books of the Bible, and those copies are so early, so far as ancient documents, you know, by the standards of ancient documents, that very quickly you get onto the question of whether you can believe the evidence in them. And as to that, I mean, one feature of the evidence that really impressed me was that the preaching of the resurrection is there front and centre of the gospel right at the start. You know, a prime example is Paul's letter to the Corinthians. Just a little passage in there that I remember being struck by, if I can read that. So he writes to them, "For what I received, I passed on to you as of first importance, that Christ died for our sins according to the Scriptures, that he was buried, that he was raised on the third day according to the Scriptures, and that he appeared to Cephas and then to the 12. After that, he appeared to more than 500 of the brothers and sisters at the same time, most of whom are still living, though some have fallen asleep. Then he appeared to James, then to all the apostles." So there is the central fact being asserted in the lifetime of the witnesses. Now, if that was demonstrably false, it seemed to me the teaching could never get off the ground. I mean, anyone in Jerusalem could have proved the falsity of in their lunch hour by visiting the tomb. And there were a raft of other features of the evidence which I was impressed by. Two that I can recall now in particular. One was that the accounts, the gospel accounts, including of the resurrection, vary. Now, one line of cross-examination that you see in court quite a lot is that, well, look, the witness statements of the witnesses on this side, they're all virtually identical, and therefore the accounts are not to be believed. And that actually is an effective line of cross-examination, because the point is that real events happen in 3D, so that each person will have a different perception of them. You know, a real event, you can see around the back of it and see it from either side. Whereas that which is made up tends to be a cardboard cutout. You know, it presents one face only. And so it's to be distrusted. And, you know, we've probably all come across that idea. I mean, I came across it recently in a Nordic thriller. I do quite like a Nordic thriller. So this is, I'm going to read you a little bit of dialogue. And this is a journalist who is doubting an account that a death is an accident. And he says, "It's still mostly a gut instinct. I went to Uppsala and read all the witness statements, and there's actually nothing inconsistent or odd about them, except, well, precisely, that there is nothing odd about them. If I've learned anything over the years, it's that the truth is generally a little unexpected or even illogical, since we humans aren't entirely rational, whereas lies, as a rule, tend to be consistent and comprehensive and often sound like a cliche, especially if the liars aren't very good. So the investigation into Carl's death is a cliche," she said. "Is that it?" "The whole thing hangs together a little too well," Blomqvist said. "There aren't enough inconsistencies and too few details that really stand out." Well, the gospel accounts are rich in a way that helped convince me they're not made up, and there are certainly plenty of striking details as part of those accounts. Now, the other feature of the evidence which I recall affecting me was not only that they don't vary, the accounts, but that the disciples, so the eyewitnesses themselves, come off very poorly in the accounts. Another thing you learn reading witness statements that don't tell the whole truth is that the people inventing them come off rather well in the stories. They tend to come out smelling of roses. Whereas when you read the gospel accounts, that is not so for the disciples. They get things wrong. They're slow to learn. They get rebuked. They let Jesus down. And to me, all those were badges of truth. And of course, all of this is before you even get to the figure of Jesus himself. You know, C.S. Lewis famously highlighted that if he's not who he said he was, then he's either utterly mad or simply evil for deluding people into following him to their deaths. You know, it's Lord, liar, or lunatic. And when you read his words, they're sheer sense and, you know, compassion, what lies behind them. You really are, I think, you know, led to that conclusion that he is who he said he was, that he is Lord. And the other thing to say, you know, perhaps finally, is that better lawyers than me have believed. So I remember a quote from a former Lord Chief Justice, Lord Caldecott. He said this. He said that applying an evidential approach to the cardinal test of the claims of Jesus Christ, namely his resurrection, has led me, as often as I have tried to examine the evidence, to believe it as a fact beyond dispute. And perhaps I can finish the answer with some words of Mr. Justice Cook, a recent head of the Commercial Court. He said, "The problem in the end is not with the evidence. The issue is whether or not we're prepared to follow where the evidence leads and to act on it." As they tend to say in the Court of Appeal, I agree.
So the Bible is a collection of 66 books, 39 in what we call the Old Testament, 27 in the New Testament. It was written over a period of some 1600 years by more than 40 authors. Authors who came from a very wide variety of backgrounds. Kings and diplomats, fishermen and leather workers and medics. It was written in three languages, Hebrew, Greek and Aramaic. And it was written across three continents, Asia, Africa and Europe. And despite all that variety, it essentially tells one story. And as Alan's already suggested to us, there's one person who is at the centre of the Bible story, and that person is Jesus. And as you know, most of you will know, we find out about Jesus in what we call the four Gospels, Matthew, Mark, Luke and John. They describe his life and work. So let's have a look and see what one of those authors said. This is Luke. He wrote these words at the very start of his account. Inasmuch as many have undertaken to compile a narrative of the things that have been accomplished among us, just as those who from the beginning were eyewitnesses and ministers of the word have delivered them to us, it seemed good to me also, having followed all things closely for some time past, to write an orderly account for you, most excellent Theophilus, that you may have certainty concerning the things you have been taught. So notice that Luke isn't claiming he was an eyewitness. But what he tells us is that he has followed all things closely. Now, that doesn't mean he was a spectator. That means he was engaged. He's carefully investigated all that was going on. In other words, he's checked out what people have said. We can presume maybe he's interviewed some of those who were there. Some of those who heard Jesus in the flesh. Some of those who saw Jesus do stuff. And so it's very interesting, isn't it? That same point Alan made about there were people around who you could have gone to ask. Did you see that or not? Was that true or not? Luke is exactly opening up the same point. There are people you can go and ask to corroborate the evidence. Alan also mentioned that he, along with many other people, thought that the Bible was just an interesting collection of made-up stories. Well, we know how those sort of stories start, don't we? They tend to start along the lines of a long time ago in a land far away. And so it progresses. But it's interesting that in the next verse of Luke, he begins the account by saying, in the days of Herod, king of Judah. He's very exact about time and place and people. We'll come back to that in a moment. So Jesus is the centerpiece. And we know from his words, Jesus' words, that he trusted the Old Testament. That was his Bible. That was what he would have grown up on and been taught in synagogue. And there's one very particular instance in Mark's account where he's disputing with the religious leaders. And he says this, Jesus said to them, is this not the reason you're wrong? Because you know neither the scriptures nor the power of God. They were wrong because they didn't understand the scriptures properly. And in order to know the truth, in order to be right, in order to not be in error, you need to know the scriptures. And that's a principle on which Jesus operated throughout his life and ministry. You will see that sort of thing repeated page after page, should you read a gospel. But of course, both of those opening sort of points are self-confirming, aren't they? So let's look outside the pages of the Bible for a bit. So let's tackle the question of the existence of Jesus. I'm sure, given time, you could name all of these fine fellows, but we haven't got much time, so we won't do that. We've got Josephus and Tacitus up the top. They, along with a guy called Thallus, all mention Jesus as an historical figure. All three of them talk about Jesus' death by crucifixion, his conviction by the Roman authorities, and Thallus talks about the fact that whilst he was on the cross, there was darkness over the land. Josephus also has a passage where he talks about the resurrection. It's worth saying, though, that that passage is disputed, despite it coming in the earliest manuscripts we have of his work. The two guys at the bottom are Suetonius and Pliny the Younger, and they both talk about Jesus, but they talk about Jesus in relation to Christians, in relation to the church. But there's no doubt that they understand the reason for their being Christians and the church, the person of Jesus. So there is good historical reference from contemporary historians that Jesus existed. So what about the wider Bible record? How does that fare when it's held up to the bar of historical and archaeological finds? I can't imagine anybody knows what the top left-hand item is.
Is it a Weetabix?
I think it's half a Bourbon that Phil has failed to finish off. That's my sort of particular view. But it's a cuneiform tablet from the reign of King Nebuchadnezzar. And it talks about an official of Nebuchadnezzar's who was present at the siege of Jerusalem. And in Jeremiah 39 and verse 3, this particular official is mentioned. And his particular role within the household is also mentioned in Jeremiah. And it is that role that is confirmed by this particular little tablet. He was the chief eunuch of the household. So it's just one of those very interesting little bits of history that are confirmed by something that's been dug up, and you can now see it in the British Museum. And if you're interested, you can do a whole tour in the British Museum, which will take you through many, 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 many more of these sorts of examples. The bottom right-hand one is, of course, the Pool of Siloam. In John's Gospel, he talks about the pools of Bethesda and the Pool of Siloam. And for many, many years, people thought these were just interesting locations that John had created to be a useful backdrop to Jesus' miracles and teaching. And then, surprise, surprise, they discover them. They find them. They dig them up. And they find that what they dig up is exactly as John has described it, with porticos and with steps down into the pool and so on and so forth. Pool of Siloam there was only dug up in 2004. There's a lot of archaeological digging going on around Jerusalem today. We talked about Luke's gospel and his claim to reliability to have researched things. Just a couple of things there. In Acts 18, he talks about the dates of somebody called Gallo. And everyone thought, well, I'm not sure about that. But then they dug up a tablet giving Gallo's dates, which tie in with what Luke says. He also, when describing his travels around the Mediterranean, talks about the titles of the officials running various bits of the Roman provinces. And as archaeology has revealed their titles, every single one of those titles has accorded with what Luke tells us in the Acts. Let's think a bit about the manuscripts. Alan talked about the importance of this a little while ago. Did anybody watch? There was a terrific programme on Hannibal crossing from sort of Spain into Italy on Channel 4 back in September. Anyone see that? It was terrific. And the interesting thing that was mentioned there was that the historian who recorded all this, a guy called Polybius, he wrote the definitive account of Hannibal crossing the Alps in, he wrote it some 60 years after the events happened. And yet Polybius' account is the account. So here we have three historical documents which are reckoned to be the reliable testimony from Caesar, from Thucydides, and from Tacitus. Now, the gap between the event and when they were written is an important gap, and also the number of manuscripts that are still around which have an ancient dating. So Caesar's Gallic War was written in 110-144. The earliest one we have is AD 900. The gap there is about 1,000 years. And the number of manuscripts we have is 10. And so for Thucydides, and so for Tacitus. Okay? So, how does the New Testament match up to what we're talking about? The New Testament written between AD 40 and 100, a number of people would say, some would argue it was written before AD 70 for particularly historic reasons, but we'll put a more generous date on the end of that. The earliest fragment is around in AD 125. That's a gap of 25 to 50 years. And the number of documented fragments available, whoops, is 24,000. So Alan said those numbers are pretty staggering, and those numbers are pretty staggering. Now, you could add the Dead Sea Scrolls to that. The Dead Sea Scrolls were discovered in 1947. There was a shepherd boy on the hillsides of Judea. He got very bored, and he was throwing stones into a cave. That's what you do, wouldn't you? And he did that, and he threw a stone in, and suddenly he heard a sort of a crackling, a tinkling, sort of different sort of noise. So he went in to see what was there. And there were some sealed jars. Well, they weren't sealed anymore because he'd broken them. But there were jars that had been sealed since 68 AD. And those jars contained the writings of the Qumran community. They also contained some significant sections of the prophet Isaiah. And also amongst the fragments and the papers, because what he was advised to do, because obviously lots of people were interested in old documents, he and his mates worked out that if you cut them up into bits, you could sell them for much more money and you had more of them to sell. So that's basically what they did. So amongst the fragments, we have bits of Mark's Gospel. We have bits of the Acts of the Apostles, we have bits of Romans, we have bits of 1 Timothy, 2 Peter, and James. And remember, they were put into those pots in 68 AD. Another interesting thing about the whole Dathian timescale thing is that there are quotations from New Testament books, what we now know as New Testament books, that occur in the writings of the early church as early as AD 95 or 115. So the documentary manuscript stuff is very strong. But of course there's another important question that we've got to answer. Does reading the Bible, does the Bible actually tie in to my experience? Does it speak about the world in which I live? Does it speak to what I know about the world today? We live in a beautiful and complex world. As Freddie Flintoff was saying on the radio the other day, where on earth did it come from? And yet we notice, we know, we want to know why is there so much unkindness, evil and discord in such a world. This morning at a church, David Dreyer was preaching, and he just reminded us of the delusion that so many people were under at the end of the First World War. He quoted what the Prime Minister, David Lloyd George, said on the morning of the announcement 100 years ago. Thus this fateful morning came to an end all wars. The leader of the opposition echoed his words. Where does that delusion come from? Because, as we know, the 20th century has seen more wars than the previous century and more slaughter than any previous century. And the Bible answers that question. It says that humanity is fatally flawed. Jesus talks in Mark chapter 7 about the problem being the human heart. We are the ones from whom the evil comes because we have rejected God and done our own way. And we know ourselves, don't we? We cannot turn over a new leaf. We cannot help ourselves. We cannot become the people that we want to be, and we find ourselves burdened by guilt. Let me tell you about two guys that I've engaged with over the years. I suggested to one of them that we should read Mark's Gospel together. He said, I don't need to do that. I know Mark's Gospel because I did it for O-level. That's just an exam that used to be a bit like GCSEs, but centuries ago. And guess what? When we sat down and read Mark's Gospel, he found that it was completely different from what he'd done for O-level or GCSE. He found that in the pages of that book, he met the person of Jesus. Another guy. We sat down to do a bit of a course, and we looked at what the Bible had to say about what our world is like and the reasons for that. And he had very little, if any, church background. And he said, that's the best explanation of the state of the world I have ever heard. So, maybe you've got to give yourself an opportunity to discover that the Bible does explain the world as it is and does speak to the reality of our own hearts and minds and wills. Because, yes, we can say its reliability is proven. We can say the characters it speaks about are attested in history. The events line up, the archaeology bears it out, but that only gets us so far. The question is still, as Alan suggested as he closed, whether I'm prepared to engage with that, whether I'm prepared to give the Bible its opportunity to speak to me and to address me. Only then will we know, as Alan has discovered, that it is possible for us to trust the Bible. The evidence is there. Will we act on the evidence?